The transmitter should select a thought, which may be anything from an abstract idea to a concrete object or a simple geometrical figure. Concentrate on it, and will to impress it on his friend. It should scarcely be necessary to insist that the mind should be wholly concentrated, being in the condition graphically described by Patanjali as one-pointed. It is well for the inexperienced not to attempt to concentrate for too long lest the attention waver or wander, and a bad habit thus be set up, or strain develop, leading to fatigue. For many, if not for most, seconds are safer than minutes. The receiver, making his body as comfortable as possible, lest any slight bodily uneasiness serve to distract his attention from the matter in hand, must render his mind a blank slate task by no means easy to the inexperienced, but simple enough once the knack of it is acquired, and to note the thoughts that drift into it. These he should write down as they appear, his only care being to remain passive, to reject nothing, to encourage nothing. The transmitter should of course, also keep a record of the thoughts which he sends, and the two records should at suitable intervals be compared. Unless the experimenters are abnormally deficient in the use of the will and the control of thought, some power of communication will be established in a few weeks or months at latest. The present writer, A.E.P., has known it happen at the first attempt. The student of white occultism, once he has satisfied himself of the possibility of thought transference, will not be content either with academic experiments such as have been described above, or with merely sending out kind thoughts to his friends, useful as these may be in their own measure. It is possible for him to use his powers of thought to far greater effect. Thus, to take an obvious example, suppose the student wishes to help a man who is under the sway of an injurious habit such as drink. He should first ascertain at what hours the patient's mind is likely to be unemployed, such as his hour for going to bed. If the man should be asleep, so much the better. At such a time he should sit down alone and picture his patient as seated in front of him. Very clear picturing is not essential, but the process is rendered more effective if the image can be pictured vividly, clearly and in detail. If the patient is asleep, he will be drawn to the person thinking of him, and will animate the image of himself that has been formed. The student should then, with full concentration of mind, fix his attention on the image and address to it the thoughts which he wishes to impress on his patient's mind. He should present these as clear mental images, just as he would do if laying arguments before him or pleading with him in words. Care must be taken not to attempt to control in any way the patient's will. The effort should be solely to place before his mind the ideas which, appealing to his intelligence and his emotions, may help him to form a right judgment and to make an effort to carry it out in action. If an attempt is made to impose upon him a particular line of conduct, and the attempt succeed, even then little, if anything, has been gained. For, in the first place, the weakening effect of the compulsion on his mind may do him more harm than the wrongdoing from which he has been saved. In the second place, the mental tendency towards vicious self-indulgence will not be changed by opposing an obstacle in the way of indulging in a particular form of it. Checked in one direction, it will find another, and a new vice will supplant the old. Thus, a man forcibly constrained to be temperate by the domination of his will is no more cured of the vice than if he were locked up in prison. Apart from this practical consideration, it is entirely wrong in principle for a man to try to impose his will on another, even in order to make him do it right. True growth is not helped by external coercion. The intelligence must be convinced, the emotions aroused and purified, before real gain is made. If the student wishes to give any other kind of help by his thought, he should proceed in a similar way. As we saw in Chapter 8, a strong wish for a friend's good, sent to him as a general protective agency, will remain about him as a thought form for a time proportional to the strength of the thought, and will guard him against evil, acting as a barrier against hostile thoughts, and even warding off physical dangers. A thought of peace and consolation similarly sent will soothe and calm the mind, spreading around its object an atmosphere of calm. It is thus apparent that thought transference is closely associated with mind cure, which aims at transferring good, strong thoughts from the operator to the patient. Examples of this are Christian Science, mental science, mind healing, etc. In those methods where an attempt is made to cure a man simply by believing he is well, a considerable amount of hypnotic influence is frequently exercised. The mental, astral, and etheric bodies of man are so closely connected that if a man mentally believes himself well, his mind may be able to force his body into harmony with his mental state and thus produce a cure. H.P. Blavatsky considered it legitimate and even wise to use hypnotism to lift a person out of drunkenness, for example, provided the operator knew enough to be able to break the habit and free the will of the patient so that it might set itself against the vice of drunkenness. The willpower of the patient having become paralyzed by his addiction to drinking, the hypnotist uses the force of hypnotism as a temporary expedient to enable the man's will to recover and reassert itself. Nervous diseases yield the most readily to the power of the will because the nervous system has been shaped for the expression of spiritual powers on the physical plane. The most rapid results are obtained when the sympathetic system is first worked upon, because that system is the most directly related to the aspect of will in the form of desire, the cerebrospinal system being more directly related to the aspect of cognition and of pure will. Another method of healing requires the healer first to discover accurately what is wrong, to picture to himself the diseased organ, and then to image it as it ought to be. Into the mental thought form he has thus created, he next builds astral matter, and then by the force of magnetism he further densifies it by etheric matter, finally building in the denser materials of gases, liquids and solids, using the materials available in the body and supplying from outside any deficiencies. It is obvious that this method demands at least some idea of anatomy and physiology. Nevertheless, in the case of an advanced stage of evolution, the will of an operator who may be lacking in knowledge in his physical consciousness may be guided from a higher plane. In cures effected by this method, there is not the same danger that accompanies those wrought by the easier, and therefore more common, method of working on a sympathetic system alluded to above. There is, however, a certain danger in healing by the power of will, viz., the danger of driving the disease into a higher vehicle. Disease being often the final working out of evil that existed previously on the higher planes, it is better to let it work itself out than forcibly to check it and throw it back into the subtler vehicle. If it be the result of evil desire or thought, then physical means of cure are preferable to mental, because the physical means cannot cast the trouble back into the higher plane, as could happen if mental means were employed. Hence mesmerism is a suitable process, this being physical, see the etheric double chapter 18. A true method of healing is to render the astral and mental bodies perfectly harmonious, but this method is far more difficult and not as rapid as the will method. Purity of emotion and mind means physical health, and a person whose mind is perfectly pure and balanced will not generate fresh bodily disease, though he may have some unexhausted karma to work off, or he may even take on himself some of the disharmonies caused by others. There are, of course, other methods of using the power of thought to heal, for the mind is the one great creative power in the universe, divine in the universe, human in man, and as the mind can create, so can it restore. Where there is injury, the mind can turn its forces to the healing of the injury. In passing, we may note also that the power of glamour, vidi the astral body, is simply that of making a clear strong image and then projecting it into the mind of another. The aid which is often rendered to another by prayer is largely of the character just described, the frequent effectiveness of prayer compared with that of ordinary good wishes being attributable to the greater concentration and intensity thrown by the pious believer into his prayer. Similar concentration and intensity without the use of prayer would bring about similar results. The student will bear in mind that we are speaking here of the effects of prayer brought about by the power of the thought of the one who prays. There are, of course, other results of prayer, due to a call on the attention of some evolved human, superhuman, or even non-human intelligence, which may result in direct aid being rendered by a power superior to any possessed by the one who offers the prayer. With this type of answers to prayer, however, we are not here immediately concerned. All that can be done by thought for the living can be done even more easily for the dead. As was explained in the astral body, the tendency of a man after death is to turn his attention inwards, and to live in the feelings and mind rather than in the external world. The rearrangement of the astral body by the desire elemental further tends to shut in the mental energies and to prevent their outer expression. But the person thus checked as to his outward going energies becomes all the more receptive of influences from the mental world, and can, therefore, be helped, cheered, and counseled far more effectively than when he was on earth. In the world of the after-death life, a loving thought is palpable to the senses as is here a loving word or tender caress. Everyone who passes over should therefore be followed by thoughts of love and peace, by aspirations for his swift passage onwards. Only too many remain in the intermediate state longer than they otherwise should because they have not friends who know how to help them from this side of death. The occultists who founded the great religions were not unmindful of the service due from those left on earth to those who had passed onwards. Hence the Hindu has his shra, the Christian his masses and prayers for the dead. Similarly, it is possible for thought transference to take place in the reverse direction. That is, from the disembodied to those physically alive. Thus, for example, the strong thought of a lecturer on a particular subject may attract the attention of disembodied entities interested in that subject. An audience, in fact, often contains a greater number of people in astral than in physical bodies. Sometimes one of these visitors may know more of the subject than the lecturer, in which case he may assist by suggestions or illustrations. If the lecturer is clairvoyant, he may see his assistant and the new ideas will be materialized in subtler matter before him. If he is not clairvoyant, the helper will probably impress the ideas upon the lecturer's brain, and in such a case the lecturer may well suppose them to be his own. This kind of assistance is often afforded by an invisible helper, vide the astral body, p. 245-6. The power of the combined thought of a group of people used deliberately to a certain end is well known, both to occultists and to others who know something of the deeper science of the mind. Thus in certain parts of Christendom it is the custom to preface the sending of a mission to evangelize some special district by definite and sustained thinking. In this way a thought atmosphere is created in the district highly favorable to the spread of the teachings thought about, and receptive brains are prepared for the instruction which is to be offered to them. The contemplative orders of the Roman Catholic Church do much good and useful work by thought, as do the recluses of the Hindu and Buddhist faiths, where in fact, a good and pure intelligence sets itself to work to aid the world by diffusing through it noble and lofty thoughts. Their definite service is done to man, and the lonely thinker becomes one of the lifters of the world. Another example, which we may class as partly conscious and partly unconscious, of the way in which the thought atmosphere of one man can powerfully affect another man, is that of the association of a pupil or disciple with a spiritual teacher or guru. This is well understood in the East, where it is recognized that the most important and effective part of the training of a disciple is that he shall live constantly in the presence of his teacher and bathe in his aura. The various vehicles of the teacher are all vibrating with a steady and powerful swing at rates both higher and more regular than any which the pupil can maintain, though he may sometimes reach them for a few moments. But the constant pressure of the stronger thought waves of the teacher gradually raise those of the pupil into the same key. A rough analogy may be taken from musical training. A person who has yet but little musical ear finds it difficult to sing correct intervals alone, but if he joins with another stronger voice which is already perfectly trained, his task becomes easier. The important point is that the dominant note of the teacher is always sounding so that its action is affecting the pupil night and day without the need of any special thought on the part of either of them. Thus it becomes much easier for the growth of the subtle vehicles of the pupils to take place in the right direction. No ordinary man, acting automatically and without intention, can exercise even 100th part of the carefully directed influence of a spiritual teacher. But numbers may to some extent compensate for lack of individual power, so that the ceaseless though unnoticed pressure exercised upon us by the opinions and feelings of our associates leads us frequently to absorb, without knowing it, many of their prejudices, as we saw in the preceding chapter, when dealing with racial and national thought influence. An accepted pupil of a master is so closely in touch with the master's thought that he can train himself at any time to see what that thought is upon any given subject. In that way he is often saved from error. The master can at any time send a thought through the pupil either as a suggestion or a message. If, for example, the pupil is writing a letter or giving a lecture, the master is subconsciously aware of the fact, and may at any moment throw into the mind of the pupil a sentence to be included in the letter or used in the lecture. In earlier stages, the pupil is often unaware of this, and supposes the ideas to have arisen spontaneously in his own mind, but he very soon learns to recognize the thought of the master. In fact, it is most desirable that he should learn to recognize it, because there are many entities on the mental and astral planes who, with the best intentions and in the most friendly way, are very ready to make similar suggestions, and it is clearly necessary that the pupil should learn to distinguish from whom they come. Chapter 13 Thought Centers. There are in the mental world certain definitely localized thought centers, actual places in space, to which thoughts of the same type are drawn by the similitude of their vibrations, just as men who speak the same language are drawn together. Thoughts on a given subject gravitate to one of these centers, which absorbs any number of ideas, coherent or incoherent, right or wrong, the center being a kind of focus for all the converging lines of thought about that subject, these again, being linked by millions of lines with all sorts of other subjects. Philosophical thought, for example, has a distinct realm of its own with subdivisions corresponding to the chief philosophical ideas. All sorts of curious interrelations exist between these various centers, exhibiting the way in which different systems of philosophy have linked themselves together. Such collections of ideas represent all that has been thought upon that subject. Anyone who thinks deeply, say on philosophy, brings himself in touch with this group of vortices. If he is in his mental body, whether he be asleep or dead, he is drawn spatially to the appropriate part of the mental plane. If the physical body to which he may be attached prevents this, he will rise into a condition of sympathetic vibration with one or other of these vortices, and will receive from them whatever he is capable of assimilating, but this process will be somewhat less free than would be the case if he had actually drifted into it. There is not precisely a thought center for drama and fiction, but there is a region for what may be called romantic thought, a vast, but rather ill-defined group of forms, including on one side a host of vague but brilliant combinations connected with the relation of the sexes, on another the emotions characteristic of medieval chivalry, and on yet another masses of fairy stories. The influence of thought centers on people is one of the reasons why people think in droves like sheep, for it is much easier for a man of lazy mentality to accept a ready-made thought from someone else than to go through the mental labor of considering a subject and arriving at a decision for himself. The corresponding phenomenon in the astral world works in a slightly different manner. Emotion forms do not all fly up to one world center, but they do coalesce with other forms of the same nature in their own neighborhood, so that enormous and very powerful blocks of feeling are floating about almost everywhere, and a man may very readily come into contact with them and be influenced by them. Examples of such influence occur in cases of panic, maniacal fury, melancholia, etc. Such undesirable currents of emotion reach a man through the umbilical chakra. In a similar manner, a man may be beneficially affected by noble emotions operating through the heart chakra. It is difficult to describe the appearance of these reservoirs of thought. Each thought appears to make a track, burrowing a way for itself through the matter of the plane. That way, once established, remains open, or rather may readily be reopened, and its particles revivified by any fresh effort. If this effort be at all in the general direction of the first line of thought, it is far easier for it to adapt itself sufficiently to pass along that line than it is for it to hew out for itself a slightly different line, however closely parallel that may be to the one which already exists. The content of these thought centers is, of course, far more than enough for any ordinary thinker to draw upon. For those who are sufficiently strong and persevering, there are yet other possibilities connected with these centers. First, It is possible through these thought centers to reach the minds of those who generated their force. Hence one who is strong, eager, reverent, and teachable, may actually sit at the feet of great thinkers of the past and learn from them of the problems of life. A man is thus able to psychometrize the different thought forms in a thought center, follow them to their thinkers, with whom they are connected by vibration, and acquire other information from them. Second, there is such a thing as the truth in itself, or, if that idea is too abstract to be grasped, we may say it is the conception of that truth in the mind of our solar logos. That thought can be contacted by one who has attained conscious union with the deity, but by no one below that level. Nevertheless, reflections of it are to be seen, cast from plane to plane, growing ever dimmer as they descend. Some at least of these reflections are within reach of a man whose thought can soar up to meet them. From the existence of these thought centers follows another point of considerable interest. It is obvious that many thinkers may be drawn simultaneously to the same mental region, and may gather there exactly the same ideas. When that happens, it is possible also that their expression of those ideas in the physical world may coincide, then they may be accused by the ignorant of plagiarism. That this does not happen more frequently than actually is the case is due to the density of men's brains, which comparatively rarely bring anything learned on higher planes. This phenomena happens not only in the field of literature, but also in that of inventions, for it is well known in patent offices that practically identical inventions often arrive simultaneously. Other ideas may be obtained by writers from the Akashic records, but this aspect of our subject will be dealt with in a later chapter. Chapter 13 Physical or Waking Consciousness. In this chapter, we shall consider the mental body as it exists and is used during ordinary waking consciousness, that is, in ordinary physical life. It will be convenient to deal seriatim with the three factors which determine the nature and functioning of the mental body in physical life, viz. 1. The physical life, 2. The emotional life, 3. The mental life, 1. The physical life in the astral body. Chapter 8, the factors in the physical life which affect the astral body were enumerated and described. Most of what was written there applies, mutatis mutandis, to the mental body. We shall here, therefore, not deal again at any length with those factors, but merely briefly recapitulate them, with a minimum of comment where necessary. As every part of the physical body has its corresponding astral and mental counterparts, it follows that a coarse and impure physical body will tend to make the mental body also coarse and impure. In view of the fact that the seven grades of mental matter correspond respectively to the seven grades of physical, as well, of course, as to those of astral matter, it would seem that the mental body would be more especially affected by the physical solids, liquids, gases, and ethers. That is, by the four orders of physical matter. It will, of course, be clear to the student that a mental body composed of the coarse varieties of mental matter will respond to the coarser types of thought more readily than to the finer varieties. Coarse food and drink tend to produce a coarse mental body. Flesh foods, alcohol, tobacco are harmful to the physical, astral and mental bodies. The same applies to nearly all drugs. Where a drug, such as opium, is taken in order to relieve great pain, it should be taken as sparingly as possible. One who knows how to do it can remove the evil effect of opium from the mental and astral bodies after it has done its work upon the physical. Furthermore, a body fed on flesh and alcohol is especially liable to be thrown out of health by the opening up of the higher consciousness. Nervous diseases, in fact, partly due to the fact that the higher consciousness is trying to express itself through bodies clogged with flesh products and poisoned by alcohol. Dirt of all kinds is often objectionable in the higher worlds than in the physical. Thus, for example, the mental and astral counterparts of the waste matter which is constantly being thrown off by the physical body as invisible perspiration are of the most undesirable character. Loud, sharp or sudden noises should, as far as possible, be avoided by anyone who wishes to keep his astral and mental bodies in order. This is one of the reasons why the life of a busy city is one to be avoided by an occult student, as well as by children upon whose plastic astral and mental bodies the effects of ceaseless noise are disastrous. The cumulative effect of noise on the mental body is a feeling of fatigue and inability to think clearly. A man's mental body is affected by almost everything in his environment. Thus, for example, the pictures which hang on the walls of his rooms influence him, not only because they keep before his eyes the expression of certain ideas, but also because the artist puts a great deal of himself, of his inmost thought and feeling, into his work. This we term the unseen counterparts of the picture, clearly expressed in mental and astral matter, and these radiate from the picture just as surely as scent inheres in and radiates from a flower. Books are specially strong centers of thought forms, and their unnoticed influence in a man's life is often a powerful one. It is, therefore, unwise to keep on one's bookshelves books of an unpleasant or undesirable character. Talismans or amulets affect a man's life to some extent. They have already been described in the etheric double and the astral body. Briefly, they operate in two ways. 1. They radiate waves of their own which are intrinsically helpful. 2. The knowledge of the presence and purpose of the talisman awakens the faith and courage of the wearer and thus calls up the reserve strength of his own will. If a talisman is linked with its maker, and the wearer calls upon the maker mentally, the ego will respond and reinforce the vibrations of the talisman by a strong wave of his own more powerful thought. A talisman strongly charged with magnetism may thus be an invaluable help. The physical nature, as well as the emotions and the mind, have to be mastered, and the physical is, without doubt, the most difficult to deal with. Some people scorn such things as talismans, others have found the path to occultism so arduous that they are glad to avail themselves of any assistance that may be offered to them. The strongest talisman on this planet is probably the rod of power, which is kept at Shamba and used in initiations and at other times. A man is affected also by the colors of objects which surround him. For just as a feeling or thought produces in subtler matter a certain color, so, conversely, the presence of a given color even in physical objects exerts a steady pressure, tending to arouse a feeling or thought appropriate to that color. Hence the rationale, for example, of the use of certain selected colors by the Christian Church in altar frontals, vestments, etc., in the endeavor to superinduce the condition of mind and feeling especially appropriate to the occasion. A man is affected by the walls and furniture of his rooms because, by his thoughts and feelings, he unconsciously magnetizes physical objects near him, so that they possess the power of suggesting thoughts and feelings of the same type, either to himself or to any person who puts himself in the way of their influence. Striking instances of this phenomena occur, as is well known, in the case of prison cells and other similar places. Hence, also, the value of holy places, where the atmosphere is literally vibrating at a high rate. A room set apart for meditation and high thought soon gains an atmosphere purer and subtler than that of the surrounding world, and the wise student will take due advantage of this fact both for his own sake and for the helping of those around him. As an example of this kind of thought force, we may cite the case of certain ships or engines which have the reputation of being unlucky. Instances have unquestionably occurred where accident after accident occurs in connection with them without apparent reason. The effect could have been brought about in some such way as the following. Feelings of intense hatred may have been entertained against the builder of the ship or against her first captain. These feelings of themselves would probably not be sufficient actually to cause serious misfortune. But in the life of every ship there are many occasions on which an accident is only just averted by vigilance and promptitude, in which a single moment's delay or slackness would be sufficient to precipitate a catastrophe. Such a mass of thought, forms as those described would be amply sufficient to cause that momentary lack of vigilance or momentary hesitation, and that would be the easiest line along which the malignity could work. It is clear that the reverse is also true, and that a lucky atmosphere can be built up about material objects, etc., by the optimistic and cheerful thoughts of those who use the objects. Similarly with regards to relics. Any article highly charged with personal magnetism may continue to radiate its influence for centuries with practically undiminished force. Even if the relic be not genuine, the force poured into it by centuries of devotional feeling will magnetize it strongly and make it a force for good. There is thus occult wisdom in the following advice, quaint as it is an expression: knead love into the bread you bake, wrap strength and courage in the parcel you tie for the woman with the weary face, hand trust and candor with the coin you pay to the man with the suspicious eyes.